Excellent.
Hey, Paul, it's Phil. I'm finally on
Phil,
the line.
You've managed to get in.
Oh, Phil.
Yeah. There's problems with the dial-in number in parts of the United States, so I've been finally figured out an alternative, and I've been sending that out to all the people who couldn't join us. So we'll have more people on the line in a minute, I think.
Excellent.
In any event, let me just say it's Tuesday, July 11, 2017. This is the Reading Odyssey. We're talking about Antigone. Andre, you and Paul, I know, began already, but sorry for barging in there, being late.
Not at all. Alan asked a question, and Paul graciously is responding. So,
And then I was going on. I'll just wrap up by saying that to a play you've already read, the Oedipus Tyrannus. Now, Tyrannus there can mean just king, but it can also mean tyrant. In that play, Oedipus, likewise, like Creon, seems to go above and beyond what he ought legitimately to do, and therefore his own position becomes questionable, and people have identified that sort of brilliance, because he's terribly clever. He solves the riddle of the Sphinx. He cures the plague of Thebes, but, oh dear, you know, the truth comes out. He's really the son of the woman that he's married, you know. So there was a sort of frisson there, a sort of hint that Pericles perhaps had better watch it. His own personal relations were irregular, as you, I'm sure, know. He lived with a woman with whom he couldn't be married by a law that he himself had proposed. So Aspasia cannot be his wife because she's not Athenian. So anyway, there are hints that's connected, yeah.
All right, good. I appreciate that, Paul, because what I picked up was it's just about that time that the Pericles has embezzled, is a kind word, the Delphian League treasury. And in the play, there's a phrase, you know, money's the root of all evil.
Ah, yes, right.
And I just worry if that was a direct shot at...
Well, he was accused of, but he said that, of course, he hadn't embezzled it. He was using it for the good of the Athenians, but it was actually not for his personal gain, which probably was the case, because for everything we know about Pericles, he wasn't interested in living the life of luxury personally. He was rather austere in his manner of life and his tastes, his food consumption, his wine drinking. Apparently he never went to parties, which is quite interesting. Aristocrats of his class typically would go to drinking parties. He never did, apparently. So there is a sense in which he was justified in saying that he wasn't personally corrupt.
Oh, I understand. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, no, welcome. But I'm going to keep quiet because I think I'm... Isn't that right, Phil? You would like me to come in a bit later. Is that right?
Although I think we all would love listening to you for the hour plus.
No.
Paul.
You can spend your head with us. No.
Why don't we try for a few minutes. Andre, you want to lead us through a couple conversations on Antigone, and then we can bring Paul back in?
Okay. Well, welcome, everybody. Why don't we get a quick update on who's on the line with us. I know Alan's here and Paul and Phil. Who else has been able to join us?
Frank Rensler.
Frank, okay.
This is Nick.
Stephen Riddle.
Nick is on the line. Who else?
Bill Swislow.
Stephen Riddle.
Bill.
Bill Swislow.
Yeah. Okay, Bill and Stephen Riddle, good.
And Harry
Anybody
Keller.
Else? Harry?
Okay. Harry is here.
Good.
Scott Thompson, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm on.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Hey, Scott, good. Okay, very good. Well, welcome, everybody. And we discussed Oedipus Rex, as you all know, last week, and we couldn't help overlapping into Antigone from time to time. I mean, we have Creon in both, and you know, the Oedipus cycle, if you will, connects them. But I didn't think we really did it justice. So we had some discussions last time about fate versus individual action and so forth on the part of Oedipus especially. And we've had some interesting comments. Bill, are you on the line with us right now?
Yeah, me?
Yeah.
Swislow? Yeah.
Yes, yes. Bill, you sent a great email out earlier, and it's, I don't know, I just wanted to know if you wanted to, you know, ask any more about that, and we could use that to kind of get things started. That
I'd have to remember the email.
Well, let me remind you here. I have it in front of me. I know you had read Oedipus at Colonus, and Paul remarked about, you know, the idea that Oedipus the king could have been a tyrant and so forth. Well, here's Oedipus in his older age and so forth, and you say you get the sense of Oedipus as indeed self-involved, as was mentioned in the call, someone who was driven by the need to do the right thing, come what may. In other words, perhaps that's his fatal flaw. A too single-minded.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
folk.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that you know, Oedipus is so driven by his own personal sense of honor that, yeah, he's willing to, you know, sacrifice the lives of his children, among others, in order to, you know, to you know, do what he thought was the right thing, which was to make himself, you know, to self-exile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you consider the disaster that proved for his whole family. I mean, it was, of course, in line with the sense of his family's cursed. You know, and the other thing that was striking at Oedipus at Colonus was, you know, it gave you a little more insight, too, into Antigone and, you know, sort of her willingness to also sacrifice herself, you know, on the altar of honor and duty, which clearly plays out in this play, right? But,
mm-hmm.
you know, she basically has spent her adult life taking care of her cursed father, right, because of his self-righteousness, you know,
yeah.
And then she ends up, you know, sacrificing herself both to her father and then to her the honor of her family and her brother through her sense of righteousness. So, yeah, I thought that was, you know, it adds some perspective to these characters that I don't think, particularly Antigone, you know, there's a lot more time spent with her in Oedipus at Colonus, right? So you have a better sense of what she's about.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes. And I had also been interested in reading more about Polynices and Theocles and reading Seven Against Thebes. So, so you kind of get the backstory through that with those two. Now, could those two, having killed each other, could we also maybe say that they perhaps sacrificed themselves or fell into this curse of this family in the sense that they sacrificed themselves in the name of what they believed was justice, right? In their own way. And then that leads into Antigone's dilemma as well. That's where the play opens, and that curse, if you will, the evil that was left behind by Oedipus in line two, is how this play opens up. So I think it's very pertinent for you to say what you said and to bring that up. How much of this was in Oedipus's power to you know, determine, and how much was not? You know, that was another thing in Oedipus. And if there's any way to even come to any conclusion about that, is Antigone facing a similar situation? Does she have a choice to make that? You know, that is not already predetermined. I think that's a couple of things for us to think about. All right, any comments on that or any other comments or observations? Favorite quotes?
sure there's favorite passages that people want to share or moments in the play. Maybe everyone's just still getting their bearings after the technical troubles at the beginning of the call. Frank, you always... No, go ahead. Sorry, who's that?
An observation more than a... more than a comment. I like this play a lot, and I like the fact that, of course, Jean Anouilh had adapted this play as a sort of protest against the collaborationists and the Nazi occupation. But what I found most interesting, I had gone some years ago to a presentation of the play, and it was presented in a fairly, a professional company, but not really in the Greek choral style. It was presented as a Greek play, but kind of in a modern play sense. And one of the things that it really impressed upon me was the importance of comic relief, as in Shakespeare, because toward the end of the play, we've had crisis after crisis after crisis, death after death after death. A messenger comes on stage and says, "Sire, your wife is dead." And the entire audience broke out laughing because it was just one step too far. Everything had gone wrong, and it was just, it was because there was no relief, at least in that translation, it just struck everybody. I mean, it was universal. What I admired in this translation was that there is some sort of sly, I won't say humor as such, but undercutting of the relentless tragedy. I can't recall exact passages, but there are places where there's a little bit of relief to the overall deadly tone of the whole thing.
Okay.
Now, I wonder if that's more of a modern sensibility. I mean, I wonder if that's our modern reading of it, which... It does. I don't disagree with you that it it just seems one tragedy too far. On the other hand, interesting to consider what are the pieces in this play that the Athenians would have most connected to that we maybe have a hard time seeing in the context that we're in, right? So for example, a lot of, I think, what the Athenians related to were the digs against, the abuses from tyrants and the moments where it's clear that, the tyrant is where it's such a bad decision to have no other voices, no voices other than the tyrants be able to make decisions. I think that meant a lot, obviously, to the Athenians who are watching this. But it's funny because I had a little bit of that same response, but I asked that question, like, to what degree are we seeing that with eyes that are irrevocably modern, if you will, as opposed to what 2,500 years ago felt like in terms of this play.
This is Andre. Can I just throw this out? Is there any relief, or could the chorus leader be read as somehow an irritant to Creon, and in a way could be performed as as sort of a, almost as a pest, and in a sense being sort of a comic, I don't want to say comic, but, a little bit of a lightning, or not, or he's read as a very, serious character that Creon, and showing Creon's wrestling or struggling. But, I mean, it just seems that, especially on line 280, Creon just loses his...
Oh, hang on just a second. Give us a second to get to the line number. Yep, 280.
Yeah, 280, line 280. The chorus leader has, and Creon have been sort of exchanging words, and so is the guard. And at some point,
The guard is a comic relief. I think that would be.
He does. He really does.
Yeah, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andre.
Unfortunately, he leaves the play after 400 lines. Unfortunately.
But he's such an—he seems such an idiot. And so
this scene, you know, where he kind of he intercedes here. I mean, it could be performed that way. I mean, to some extent, and so. It is a very, very heavy play, and I think it would be hard to sustain that tragic, aura the whole way through. So I don't know. I mean, that's one of the points there that I felt it was, not as heavy. So
yeah. I guess one of the troubles that I have, and I'll be very interested in Paul's opinion on this in a moment after we discuss amongst ourselves for a little while longer. But as a modern, it is hard for me to connect to a play that does seem so driven by fate, by choices that are out of the hands of the principal characters. So it feels hard for me to connect to that. I actually saw a production of Antigone last year by an inner city youth program that was remarkable. First, that these kids took the text, made it their own. They turned it into, an echo of the Iraq War. And then they decided to change Antigone's fate, to put it more into her hands and to not have her die at the end. And some might say, oh, you can't do that. But they had made it so much their own, which was in itself remarkable to see these kids really own this story and then change it. But, and I loved the production. I thought it was so alive and creative. But, of course, it is a change of the story. How do other readers on the call connect to this? Does the fate aspect trouble you the way it seems to trouble me? Do you find other ways to connect to the text that make it meaningful?
So this is Bill. I think Oedipus and his family seem determined by fate, but Creon does not. So in a way. Yeah. You could say that he's the relief from the immensity of the tragedy that befalls the rest of the family. He's the one who's sort of a comic relief in the sense that he plays the fool. I mean, he makes his own decisions and his own choices, and he proves to be, I think, an incompetent tyrant. I mean, he doesn't seem able to deliver. He makes one bad choice after another, and unlike certain figures who one could say the same thing about in our time, even his son tells him, he's foolish, he's a fool. In line 90, I think I'm looking on a Kindle version, but his son is challenging him, and Creon's only response is, so now the city will give me my orders. Rulers own their cities. Isn't that the saying? And his son is disputing it. So I think Creon is maybe the most interesting character because he's the one who's actually in control. He just makes one stupid mistake after another, I think.
Well, yes, Bill.
I guess on to your point,
No, go ahead, Frank. Frank, go ahead.
So I was going to say, Creon is the only person that doesn't believe in the gods, and they have control of man's fate. He makes all these decisions, poor ones, albeit, but he does. Everybody else says, well, this is what the gods tell us we should do, so that's how we should behave. Mm-hmm. But oddly enough, at the end of the play, he's the only one that's still alive.
Barely.
Everybody else is thrown there. Barely, but he's still alive. Everybody else is dead. So it's an interesting, what you want to make of that, but that's what I always thought. He's the guy who says, we're done with the gods. Everyone else is with the gods, and yet,
And Frank, the thing that bothered me at the end of the play is that he actually did change his mind. Like, so you think that, you know, that would be a good thing, right? The guy actually finally came to his senses, but was too late. And of course, his son and Antigone, and then he gets home and his wife has killed herself. And so what are we supposed to take from this? You know, and again, maybe this is my modern sensibilities coming through, but I want the play to instruct me, and perhaps it does in terms of his earlier arrogance, but you know, it doesn't seem to say that if you make a mistake, you can recover from it, like, because he does attempt to make a change, right? And he, it's kind of remarkable. He says, "Oh, okay, yeah, let's reverse this." He does end up listening. It takes a bit, but he does. Yet that doesn't do any good.
This is Alan. But beyond the fate and the human thing, I related to this modern times. This is a debate to me about two laws: divine law and secular law. And you have, you know, the God saying, you know, religion saying there are certain things you have to do, and yet for good and sundry reasons, the lawgiver here, Creon, whether he delivers, he's got the authority, says here's the civil law. And when those are in conflict, how do you resolve it? And that's what I think, that's what I related to in this play.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Hi.
That's interesting. Yeah, who was that?
Can you, Stuart, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Yeah. You know, one thing that, on the subject of fate, one of the, this is not a favorite passage, but it was one of the more unusual things that I noticed in the play. At about line 860, 62, Antigone talks about, my father's thrice turned fate and the entire destiny that is ours, we the renowned, however you say it, Labdacids. But she doesn't blame her father and fate. She says, disaster of a mother's bed, a mother's incestuous embraces that ruined my father. I mean, that's not what we read in Oedipus. And as far as we know, there was no sort of sense of fate about what, you know, her mother's actions. I mean, when we read Oedipus, it was all the burden that Oedipus was facing in terms of the predetermination. And I sort of wondered what people made of this total, you know, inversion of the story, you know, where now it's, you know, it's the mother who is to blame, you know, whose embrace has ruined Oedipus. I don't know. Did people have a reaction to that also? Or?
That's interesting, Stuart. That's interesting. I haven't thought about that, but what Andre or other people, what did you think of that?
Hmm. Wow.
It's line 8:25 or so.
I think Antigone has an Electra complex.
So, I don't have a response to that point, but the way I related to the text, this is Nick. I was very disturbed by the progression of Creon's character between the two plays. In the first play, in the Oedipus play, you know, he's talking with Oedipus and he's telling him, you know, how he's stubborn and he's not listening, you know, like around line 540. And like around 550, he says, if you think stubbornness without knowledge worth having, you aren't thinking straight. And then around 590, he talks about, you know, well, why would I want the power? You know, I have all the joys of status, but I don't have the responsibility. And why would I want to be in charge? I don't want your job, Oedipus. And, you know, then in Antigone now he does have the power and he does, and he is in charge. And he's acting exactly like Oedipus, and he's being very stubborn, and he's not listening, and his son then berates him the exact same way that he had berated Oedipus. And to me, it's kind of scary to think, you know, I mean, like, I work in a company, and, if I get into a leadership role, you know, am I going to fall into that same kind of trap? Am I going to act like a tyrant and do the same kinds of things that the Creon is doing? Not to the same degree, of course, you know, of people dying and stuff, but am I going to be stubborn and not listen?
Nick,
so to me, I was really thinking about
the
that
answer
hard.
Is yes.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. In fact, that's actually what my next book is about, if you can believe it. The problem, it's such a great point, I really appreciate you making it. The problem is, and I think the Greeks understood this really well, and it's still true today, while we can see mistakes in others clear as day, it's much harder to see it in ourselves when we're doing the same thing. Even, you know, this experience, right? We all know this. When a spouse, you know, is doing something, we can see, oh my God, look at that. But how could they be such a fool? You know, or a friend or colleague or a boss. Yet we can make the same mistake ourselves and completely be blind to it, right? It is disturbing, and it's a great point you make.
Yeah,
I appreciate you.
One of the most disturbing things that Creon says, because he really, you know, is it's around line 560. This is this whole long dialogue with Antigone, which is just such a high point in the play. You know, and they're talking about real issues. And Creon, I mean, I can imagine the tone of certain current would-be tyrants. You know, these two girls, I say this one just now proved herself mad. And then he points at Antigone. She's been mad from birth, right? So just a dismissive, you know, he thinks he's funny. You know, I think that's where he sinks the lowest, is just the contempt that he's showing, you know, to these poor girls who have sacrificed, especially Antigone, sacrificed herself for someone who in that other play, Creon courted and tried to get his support, you know, and now he's just, you know, showering this contempt on these girls. It's just, you know, what a creep. You know, there is this, but it's the creepiness of power, of like people who think that, you know, they're special because they have more power than others. I assume that's intended, that's what he's, you know, that's the point.
Don't we think Antigone herself is a little creepy? I mean, she is so
mad,
self-righteous
though.
And so full of herself when she says, you know, I'm going to go do this, and now that you said you're not going to do it, you can't die with me because I'm so much better than you.
Right.
This is a disgusting, fundamentalist, self-righteous, wrapped up in her, you know, flag. Everything I despise in any sort of belief system comes forward in Antigone.
Oh, boy. Antigone.
Make me shudder.
All right. This is a great conversation. I have another question for you guys. What's going on with the chorus in this play? They, you know, in the middle of this tragedy, you know, the chorus goes off and talks about humanity and all the great things we've achieved and goes off on these kind of flights. Why this play? And what's going on with that? I always had a little bit of trouble with that. Does anyone have a point of view on that? That also strike anyone as strange or not really?
It did strike me. It was. I remember thinking that passage would have made more sense in Oedipus because he's a more extraordinary character than Creon is. You know, at least the way that I think he's portrayed in this play.
Yeah.
And I was struggling with an explanation for why why the playwright put it in this one. And I just didn't come up with anything that I thought made sense.
Yeah.
I had something else that troubled me, if I may.
Sure.
And that is, and I wonder if we were a Greek audience, if we would be aware of this or not. You know, Creon defends, I don't know how to pronounce it, Theocles, and blames Polynices as an invader. But according to the notes, it was Theocles who started the problem by not surrendering,
yielding,
you know,
right.
Governing and giving it over to Polynices. You know, Are we, are we aware of that? Or are we just sort of be thinking, like, gee, Creon, you know, is totally off here in terms of who he's defending, or is that a sidebar?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, that bugged me too, by the way. Like, that's part of the, like, what? How come we're not talking about that?
can I just say one thing in defense of Creon?
Sure. We'd love to hear a defense of Creon.
there's in one sense that the play treats him unfairly, just the way that the Orist diet treated Agamemnon's wife unfairly, in that there's a hint that he sacrificed his own son for the defense of the city at an earlier stage at the command of Tiresias. And if that's true, then, you know, couldn't he say, you know, I'm not asking anyone to do what I did not myself do, and put it, you know, I put the city ahead of myself. And why can't you do the same? But the playwright never makes that defense for him. So maybe the same thing with Eteocles. Maybe that's just supposed to be a sidebar that we're just not supposed to think about. But if it's right.
Although Scott, the playwright does have Creon make a speech, right, where he says the earth of our city is the most important thing and must be protected. In a way, that's perhaps at least an indirect defense.
Right, yeah. and maybe everybody who hears that speech knows that he lived by that in the past, but we don't.
Yeah. Okay.
So in regards to defending Creon, one thing maybe Paul can talk to it when he's allowed to is how outrageous
we're
was his.
To Paul here in a moment. Yeah, yeah.
How outrageous was his edict that Polynices couldn't be buried, right? So when you talk about, Antigone being the sort of, like her father, the sort of self-righteous, you know, self-absorbed person, you know, her insistence on burying her brother, come what may, you know, was who was more reasonable? Was she? Because what Creon did was just so unheard of, or was his declaration something that wasn't that unusual, and she really is sort of sealing her own fate unnecessarily? And that's the thing I didn't understand, you know, about this is was Creon being outrageous? Because if he was, then it sort of fits in with his general poor treatment throughout, that he comes off really poorly. But maybe he wasn't.
Can I pitch
let's
in
use
here?
That. Yes, Paul, I want you to let's have you join us now.
Let me pick up on the Eteocles against Polynices thing that was troubling you. Polynices' mistake from the point of view of Creon was to bring foreigners to support him against his native city. So he was a traitor in that very Greek sense that if you're not entirely with me, then you are against me. But not only that, but actually he was involving foreigners from Argos and other cities, and that was a heinous crime. And in the Greeks' eyes, traitors were beyond the pale, so they were outside the law. For example, if you were deemed to be a traitor, then you could not be buried within your home city's soil. And therefore the issue is, was Creon within his own rights to declare that Polynices was within that definition of being a traitor? Was he a traitor according to normal Greek views? And I think the tragedy resides deeply in the fact that in some ways everybody has a portion of the truth or correctness or legality, but none of them has the whole of it. In other words, what they all do wrong is go too far. And you've probably all heard of the famous Delphic injunction, nothing to excess. Well, Antigone is too extreme, as one of the speakers pointed out, in the way she promotes the notion of divine justice above human justice, which in normal course of events, traitors are traitors. They have broken the sacred bond of citizenship, and therefore they are legitimately to be punished and not to be given normal treatment as if they were merely a brother. They are actually an enemy of the state. So Antigone goes too far, but the point I was making actually before we recorded this wonderful conversation was about whether Creon, when he issues a decree off his own bat, without consultation, flying in the face of what is the normal accepted view of the ordinary citizens of Thebes, and that view is shared by Tiresias, whom I don't think we've talked enough about, because really he is the pivotal figure, because he reveals just how self-willed Creon is. In other words, how dictatorial, how tyrannical he is. That's the hinge, because Tiresias says that, you know, it's all going to end in tears, and you really have gone too far, Creon, in your attitudes, your behavior, your, well, let's be honest, despotic behavior. So no one is completely right, I think. That's part of what I want to say. And that's very true of tragedy. Often it's two rights are competing with each other. It's not the case that obviously Creon is wrong or Antigone is obviously right.
So, Paul, from your point of view, given what you've just said, I think I know the answer, but it'd be great to hear you say more about it. From your point of view, do you feel like there is, you know, for these characters, there's some sense of choice and room to maneuver, that it's not simply that their fate is sealed?
I do agree more so in this play, someone said this before, than in the Oedipus, where the oracle, which of course poor old Oedipus misreads, he therefore is, if you like, fated to carry out appalling deeds, incest, murdering his father, which, you know, murdering anybody is bad. To murder your father, patricide, is even worse than just straightforward murder. And it's unjustified. Oedipus, in the Oedipus play, you know, he gets unreasonably angry with this old man who's blocking his way. I mean, that's it. That's good enough. He not only kills, of course, Laius, his father, but he kills all Laius's men as well. I mean, he's outrageously excessive. And I think that's what's being picked up in the Antigone, that all members of Oedipus's family, that is the, from Oedipus down, that includes the four kids, not the wife, because of course she's not related to him by blood, although she is related to him in other ways, his mother and so on. But they are all cursed. They are all, there's an intrinsic flaw in their character which is leading them to behave unacceptably or illegally or flagrantly immorally. And that's bringing the tragedy down, not just on them, but on their whole communities.
Paul, in the past, when you have, I assume you've, have you taught this play with undergrads in the past?
Well, it's the most performed, you probably know, it's the most performed play of all. And one reason is it has a female, though of course played by a man originally, but a female central character. And one dimension we've not really talked about, Creon makes a huge thing of his gender. He's a man.
Of course.
And this is a female, and she's she's not a married woman, therefore she's still a virgin. She's terrifically inferior to him in status, and yet she's telling him what to do. And so there is a sort of justifiable outrage at this transgression of status, this reversal of normal status relations. But, of course, Antigone is not presenting herself merely as a woman to a man, but as a sister to a brother, and in the name of the gods. It's not she's acting as a purely human being. But to go back to your question, why was the chorus, the Ode to Man, it's called, you know, the Greek for terrible is ambiguous and ambivalent. In other words, it can mean formidable in the English sense and formidable in French, you know, amazing, but it can also mean terrifying, terrible, and potentially very destructive. And I think that's the point of putting it in this play. On the other hand, as you know, he wrote this first, quite a long time before the Oedipus, so maybe 11 years or so. So he might have dreamed up this wonderful ode and put it in the Antigone and then regretted, if only I'd put it in the Oedipus, which I agree with one of the speakers who said that it would make more point there. But, you know, he wrote it when he wrote it, so.
Yeah, yeah. And do you find, what are the, how do the undergrads relate to this play, or how do... Well, as I say, nowadays, of course,
it's all the woman's role and roles up. Yeah. They're always played by women. And the most recent version I saw had Juliette Binoche, a French actor, playing the role, actually rather poorly. Her diction was poor, but it was at the National Theatre. And it was a modern dress production. It didn't work, in my opinion, but it's because it gives a very powerful role for a woman actor. I think that's one reason today why it's thought to be desirable, you know, to put it on. Likewise, Electra, Sophocles' Electra, as opposed to Euripides' Electra, very powerful female role. The name role is extraordinarily powerful. Interestingly, Agamemnon, the play, is called Agamemnon. Well, it could just really as well have been called Clytemnestra, but it isn't. Yeah. It's called Agamemnon.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. What other questions do we have for Paul? Anything we discuss that we'd like to ask him to?
I mean, what's sometimes said is that what's, in modern terms, I think quite anachronistic, that Antigone is an individual. And Creon stands for the state, the community, the collectivity. So sometimes it's represented as a clash between individual conscience, which I think is not an ancient notion, and the impersonal power of the institutionalized state. And that probably is how Anouilh in the Second World War played it, but that to me is quite an anachronistic reading. And in the original, the issues are religion as against secular, as one of your speakers correctly put it. It's men against women, female principle against male principle, and it's the proper exercise of power as opposed to the improper exercise of power, the excessive exercise of individual autocratic soul tyrannical power as against power expressed for the good of the community. And there's one point where Creon almost anticipates Louis the 14th, you know, l'état, c'est moi. And he says, the city is mine. And, you know, and so that's very, very controversial. That would have been a point held against him by the audience, especially Democrats. Watching that, you know, oh, well, then he gets what he deserves, you know. But, of course, he doesn't suffer. That's very interesting. Like Medea in Euripides' Medea, she gets away with killing her own children. And people have argued about, you know, what was Euripides thinking or what did the audience think when they saw her get away with it? We don't know. It's an interesting thought. There's another very powerful female role. In the play,
What do you think about the point that Creon, and of course, knowing that this play was written first and Oedipus later, but that Creon seems to be a reasonable advisor in Oedipus and a tyrant.
Well, I guess some members of the audience will have seen both, and therefore they could make that comparison, but of course the plays are not to be read so much against other plays as against the other two plays in that particular performance. So in other words, Antigone was one of three plays that Sophocles had performed in, if we think, 441. Therefore, it would be more judged against those other two plays than against any other play. Now, that's in general. There is one exception, which is, of course, that there are three plays that involve Electra. Aeschylus wrote one, The Libation Bearers, then Sophocles wrote an Electra, Euripides wrote an Electra, and I think each of the subsequent playwrights, Sophocles and Euripides, were pitching their versions against the original of Aeschylus. So whether the audience would have done that, that's a different thing between the playwrights, yeah, who are conscious creators, you know, they are the dramatists. Would they have the same outlook on their work as the audience? I don't think so. So there's a kind of, yeah, internal issue as well as the reception by the audience. And of course, we know these were performed once only. I mean, to us it's extraordinary, but Sophocles' Antigone was performed precisely once in the 5th century BC. It might then have been revived later, you know, elsewhere, but in the 5th century, in Sophocles' lifetime, one performance, that's it. Extraordinary.
Wow, makes me think of productions like Coruscant or something.
Yeah.
And, do you think 500 or 1,000 years we're going to be debating? What did they mean by it?
Yes.
Why are cats so important?
And what if the actor forgot his lines, you know, on the day? We've got the text,
we've got her version of the text.
But, yeah.
Right. So, Paul, I have a question for you. And again, after I ask this, I want to hear what other people are thinking, if there are other questions. But your classicist course and historian, for you, what role in, you know, do the plays play in understanding the Greeks and, you know, versus the histories that we have access to,
yeah,
and so on? How do you think about these? I'd be interested to know.
Yeah, it's a huge question in a way, but for example, within scholarship, there's a debate as to how far plays that were made for, as I've just said, a one-off performance within a specific religious festival that's Athenian at a particular time of year, and that's it. How universal, how Greek should we think of them? Well, if they were put on at the Great Dionysia, the City Dionysia, end of March, beginning of April, then we're told foreigners might be in the audience. So to that extent, non-Athenians were receiving an Athenian play. We know that later, much later, they get disseminated, you know, they become part of Greek heritage. But initially, they are entirely Athenian and they have an Athenian-only impact. They are part of the Athenians' political, religious cycle. The very first job of the guy who by lot was appointed to be Archon and give his name to the year, called Archon Eponymous, his first job was to choose the people who would finance the tragedies and comedies at the upcoming festivals in fact, several months down the line, about 6 months later, because they came into office in July, and the first plays are put on in January, February, and then the next cycle is March, April. So they were terribly important. They were absolutely central, and I'm one of those who think that they were important to the process of democracy. In other words, it was education. It was Athenians seeing issues that might actually impact upon their everyday lives being played out. And of course, they're all set in the, mainly anyway, in the past, in another city. They're not in Athens. This is in Thebes. And so they were distanced, but nevertheless, the issues were very much contemporary and real to them. So I see it as part of doing democracy. Not the most important part, but a significant part. And also doing philosophy, because, as I say, there very often isn't a right answer. You know, each character or each idea has partial truth about it, and it's the clash of it that the two ideas, the two persons that actually produce the drama. And that may be the case in real life, that you can't reconcile conflicting principles.
And I want to follow up on maybe a dumb
question.
Sure,
and just say your name again.
It's Nick, sorry.
Hello, Nick, yeah.
So you're talking about how they would only see the play once, and I was just curious, like I know they had academies, you know, Socrates ran an academy. Did they study literature at all? Would the students there read these plays later on, or how did that work?
It's there were no formal schools beyond the very basic level of learning to read and write and do maths and so on until in the we're talking about 50 years plus after the Antigone was put on, when Isocrates and Plato and then Aristotle, they found higher learning institutes. But the Athenians didn't, as it were, do formal secondary education, what you call high school education. So they learned to read and write, and the playwrights, of course, had scripts, and the actors would have a script, and there would be then a working script, and so on and so on. So there would be a heritage that though the play was only put on once, some sort of trace of it would survive amongst professionals, people who actually devoted their lives to being actors and to financing theatre or whatever, who were theatre people. But formally, in terms of studies such as we today do of plays as literature, that's a much, much later development in the Greek world. You know, we're talking about maybe a couple of hundred years down the line for that. And it's more actually a Roman thing than a Greek thing. But when formal higher education, you know, you get a curriculum from the primary, secondary, tertiary and so on, and you'd study plays at a certain stage of your educational curriculum. But there was nothing like that in the 5th century BC that we're actually talking about.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great question, Nick.
Very good.
Okay, what else? Yeah.
Hey, Paul, I've got a question in the play that deals near the end where Antigone...
And say your name again so Paul knows.
This is Alan.
Hello, Alan, again. Well, yeah, we talked right at the beginning.
Yeah, you were at the beginning. Okay, right.
But Antigone lays out a defense for her actions, and she says, if it had been my mother or my spouse, I would not have gone against Creon, but because it was my brother and my parents were no longer alive, it's not replaceable. And I understand there's something in Herodotus like that, but this is kind of a strange passage to me. Is there a background to it?
Well, it's thought that Herodotus and Sophocles knew each other, and one of the reasons for thinking that is precisely that Herodotus tells the story. It's set in Persia, his version, and then it's not Greeks that he's talking about. And then Sophocles says, and it doesn't really work as an argument. So it's a bit like you were talking, remember, about that ode to man. That doesn't quite fit. So it's possible Sophocles wasn't entirely at his best in every aspect of the play in terms of rationality or consistency. But on the other hand, you might think, well, that's just typical of Antigone, isn't it? She uses a not very good argument because she's going to use anything she thinks can possibly justify what she's wanting to do anyway, which is bury her brother. So she's going to use this argument that she's never going to have another brother. Well, she hasn't got a brother. He's dead. So it's a very strange sort of argument. In the original, it's the woman is asked, which would she preserve? Is it her parents or her? Is it the brother or something? And it's because she can never have another brother that she opts to save the life of the brother because her parents are dead. I mean, it has a logical point in the Herodotus version, but it doesn't have a logical point in the Antigone. It's a very good question.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Frank or Andre or anyone else?
While I think of it, that other point about how Antigone goes on about her mother being more guilty than her father and the Electra complex. Somebody amusingly said she suffered from an electrical too keen, in other words, on her father, who is also, by the way, her brother. But that is an interesting point, because she does. She does act in the same way, actually, Medea does, and rather in a masculine way, because to take on Creon is something that normally another man would do. And so when Hymen, who is, of course, her betrothed fiancé, takes on his father, that's shocking in one way. Sons are not supposed to stand up to their father and call them out in the way that Hymen does, very publicly, in front of the chorus, who are, of course, the elders of Thebes. They're men, elderly men of Thebes, so as it were, representing the community. So this is a public dressing down that Hymen is giving to Creon. That's not right, but Antigone to take on Creon is doubly wrong, because not only, I've said this before, Junior, but she's a female, and so, you know, it's very transgressive. So it all fits, I think. She is quite harsh on her own sex. She's extremely nasty to her sister, as we said right at the beginning. Ismene doesn't want to bury Polynices. She respects what she takes to be the law of the city, which is what Creon has edicted. But on the other hand, when she then does want to die with Antigone, Antigone doesn't want her to share her glory in dying alone, you know, at the hands of Creon. So, yes, well, the audience, I think, would therefore lose a bit of sympathy for Antigone. I mean, the modern audience, I think, tends to have more sympathy for Antigone than the ancient audience would have had because of cultural differences.
Yeah.
I would like to, this is Andre, if I may. I agree, but I still am troubled by this one moment. It's around line 672, and Creon is talking about how he's going to hold to the law, even though Antigone is invoking Zeus.
A higher law. Yeah.
Yes. Now, he claims that anarchy destroys city. I'm quoting. There is no greater evil than anarchy. Anarchy destroys cities, tears up houses by the roots, et cetera, et cetera. And then, very soon after that, he says, we must defend good order then, and in no way, I tell you, let a woman lord it over us. Now, in a way, it's almost, to a modern sensibility, there's a lot of irony there that he's perpetuating anarchy by holding on to the law of the city. But I don't know if that's how the Greeks would have received that, if they would have seen the irony in there.
Well, remember, the total situation is anarchic. The civil war and fratricide, brother killing brother. So there's both war between factions within the city, between one city and another city, and within the family. So Thebes is totally sort of polluted. If in the eyes of an outsider, the city of Thebes is in a dreadful state. Well, Creon, rather like Oedipus after solving the riddle of the Sphinx and getting rid of the plague, Creon says, look, after this disaster of Oedipus, I have restored normality and order. And this is a big part. And the chorus accepts that, both at the beginning and at the end. They say, yes, he was better than what was before. But what he does wrong, and you put your finger on it, is create the potential for more anarchy by being excessive, by not being moderate, by not being flexible, by being, well, tyrannical, despotic, autocratic. And that is in conflict with the notion of the city, which is the normal Greek notion, would be some sort of consensus, some sort of meeting of minds. And Tiresias, who is, of course, interesting personally, because you probably know the story, he'd once been a woman and then became a man again. And so people were very interested to know whether it was better to have sex as a woman or as a man. And he allegedly said it's 10 times, you know, if you imagine sex is 10 parts, well, women get 9 parts of it, men 1. So it's 9 times better to be a woman than have good sexual experience. At any rate, he was the voice of reason, and he's rejected completely out of hand by Creon. And that really is, as I was saying, this is the pivotal point in the play. It's only later, after he sees the consequences of his edict, Antigone's dead, Hymen commits suicide, and then his wife commits suicide, then he starts to say, oh yes, maybe Tiresias had something going for him, you know. So that is a key point in the play. You're absolutely right about that, anarchy. But they would all have agreed, in principle, anarchy is terrible. But how you prevent it, or whether you're, by wishing to do certain things, causing it, these are questions. And a lot of tragedy is raising questions rather than providing answers.
Yes. Would you go as far to say that there was a... maybe an understanding that maybe a compromise was expected rather than these extreme, you know, these extreme.
If you think that the Athenians are living in a democracy where major issues are decided by a public vote, show of hands. Now, let's say it's just 51% to 49%. We over here have had a referendum, 52%, 48%. The reverberations of such a close vote are potentially quite horrendous. And so they.
What referendum do you speak of, Paul? We do not know.
I know you've not heard of this, have you? But, anyway, I won't go there. Therefore, democracy is itself, by definition, a consensus system. In other words, everybody agrees in advance. That everybody who votes counts for one, no one for more than one, and that even if the vote is 50.1% or 51%, 49%, that is the majority, that's the end of the issue. So that is a form of compromise. And what Creon refuses to do, what Antigone refuses to do, is bend at all from their position. Their initial position, yeah, and that I think is would have been seen to be excessive on both sides.
Okay. Yeah.
This is Go Nick. Ahead. I have another question.
Hey Nick, before you ask, can you hold on a second? Let me just see if there's anyone else who haven't spoken who'd like to.
Oh, sorry. Please.
No, that's okay. Yeah, just hold that. Let's just pause for a moment. Anyone else want to jump in and either comment or ask Paul a question? Okay, go ahead, Nick.
So I'm just curious, for these authors, is there any... the fact that the plays are set in Thebes, for an Athenian audience, is there some criticism just of Thebes in general? You know, these are, was there any kind of, rivalry between the cities that you can
Absolutely.
Talk
I mean,
about?
Absolutely. At the time of this, they're enemies. At the very time of the Antigone, for example, Athenians had previously actually controlled Thebes and the territory. Then they'd lost a major battle, so they no longer controlled that territory. But they were actually enemies. Thebes was allied with Sparta. Sparta was Athens' rival. They weren't actually fighting at the time, but they were not friendly. So there is indeed a very crude sort of political thing. There is a play by Euripides called The Suppliant Women. A Theban herald talking to an Athenian, actually Theseus, orders Theseus to do certain thing, and Theseus said, look, that's not the way we do things here in Athens. Of course, this is wildly anachronistic, because actually Theseus was a monarch in myth. He wasn't a democrat, but he then proceeds to rehearse a sort of democratic argument about decision-making by the people after discussion and majority vote. So the Theban, the herald, is represented as a typical oligarch, and Thebes in reality was an oligarchically run state. And Theseus is standing for, as it were, the good democrat, and Athens was, as a matter of fact, a democracy. So yes, there is that. But of course, it's not completely invented. I mean, the Oedipus is a Theban, so it's not that the Athenian perished. Now, how can we be really nasty about Thebes? I know, we'll invent this story with this terrific incest and murder and suicide, and we'll put it in Thebes. So there is a wealth of myth going way back. You know, it's not something dreamt up any time recently. And likewise about Argos or Mycenae, which is where the Oresteia is set. So that's a different case, because actually Argos was an ally of Athens. So they weren't trying to be nasty about Clytemnestra because she was an Argive or a Mycenaean. She's actually Spartan, of course, by birth. And she marries the king of Mycenae. But that wasn't part of it. There are plays, Euripides in particular, during the Peloponnesian War, Athens against Sparta, where he makes Spartan characters behave appallingly. And that's part of Athenian propaganda against Spartans. So Menelaus and his daughter Hermione and so on, they're represented as really unpleasant.
I see. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So listen, it's now I think 1:20 a.m. in Cambridge.
You're correct. It's exactly that, Phil.
And Paul, you are unbelievably generous to stay up so late to talk with us.
Yes.
It's been my pleasure as always. I shall bow out and allow you guys to carry on, because it's a really good conversation. I've learned a lot and I've been really interested, but I do need to go to bed now.
Yes, it's bedtime, I would say. Past bedtime. So thank you, Paul.
My pleasure. And
thank you, Paul.
Bye to everybody. Yeah, yeah. Lovely to talk with you. Bye for now. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Boy, I could just listen to him for hours, right?
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
Thanks for hooking that up. That was super.
Yeah, that's the magic of the Reading Odyssey, I'll tell you, is the opportunity. And you know what's so interesting is these scholars, they do love listening to our conversations, because they don't get to very often hear adults try to talk about these plays, and it's such a different experience than 18-year-olds who've not lived life yet. Anyway, so thank you guys for such a rich conversation, Andre. Thank you again. Sorry for the, I don't know what happened earlier. I had the same problem as any of you. I couldn't in, and it took me a while to find that alternative phone number. So anyway, I'm glad it all worked out.
Well, thanks for fixing that. I mean, Alan and I, we're trying to hold the fort here, but you know.
You had to call to yourself. That was great.
Oh, God.
Excellent. All right, so in August, we have one more, we extended to have one more discussion, right, Andre?
Yeah, by popular demand.
Yeah.
So it's,
and
it,
which
it,
play, again, are we reading?
It's a double feature. It's Electra by Sophocles and Euripides. So,
awesome. Double
okay.
feature.
So, yeah. It should
so
be good.
Blob
be
cool. And the body snatchers or something.
Yeah.
Oh no, I guess we'll do Electra. Okay.
I'll say, Phil, when does the Caesar edition come out from the Landmark edition?
Well, that's a thank you for asking, Frank. And the answer is I need to get back to you. I was hoping I would know more today. I should know more in August.
This is Harry. I want to point out Amazon has a publication date and release in December.
That's true. Yeah.
You have to read a few more plays.
You can go with that for now. Yeah, we can actually keep going with the Greek plays if you got, because we originally thought we were going to start Caesar in October. But Andre, you and I should talk and see if we want to do a few more Greek plays. And the nice thing about these Greek plays is, oh my gosh, unlike reading a book of Herodotus or a ton of pages of Caesar, it's a little easier to do this reading. They're
yes,
short. I appreciate that.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. You know, they're great.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm sure Paul will be happy to come back again. I know James Rahm would as well.
That would be great. I'd like to hear from him too.
Yeah, cool.
Sarah.
All right, we'll stay cool or warm or dry or whatever.
This is Steve.
Okay.
Stephen. Before we go.
Yeah.
Since we're reading Electra, two Electras next month, for those who finish and are interested, there's a very excellent version of Electra on YouTube. Richard Strauss, highly recommended. Even if you're not heavily into opera, it's only about 90 minutes long.
Can you send the link for that out to everybody?
I'll look for two links, because there's also a fantastic aria at the end of Idomeneo, King of Crete, in which Electra appears as well. And her demise is of, depending on the actress, absolutely an amazing and amusing thing. So I'll see if I
where
can
do you
find
live, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Where are you based?
Orlando.
Orlando. Oh, cool.
Okay, so I'll try to send that out to everybody.
Okay,
great.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, guys.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.